From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Global. I'm David Byrd with our daily collection of popular VOA podcasts. Coming up, U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter holds talks with Japanese allies. North Korea convenes its first major parliamentary meeting of the year. A U.S. soldier is killed in a so-called green-on-blue attack in Afghanistan. There's a verdict in the Boston Marathon bombing trial. How is history manipulated when it's taught? And Darius Rucker is loving success as a country singer. We'll check business and sports as well, all on this edition of VOA Global from the Voice of America. Welcome to Daybreak Asia, a summary of Asian news and events for Thursday, April 9, 2015. I'm David Byrd. Among today's headlines, U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter has vowed to expand defense collaboration with Japan as he held talks with his Japanese counterparts Wednesday in Tokyo. Speaking alongside Japanese Defense Minister General Nakatani, Carter said that he was committed to overseeing the next phase of the so-called rebalance. During his talks with Nakatani, Carter said he also confirmed the U.S. stance on the East China Sea islands that are at the center of a dispute with China.
I also reaffirmed President Obama's July 2014 commitment to apply our security treaty to all areas under Japanese administration and our continued strong opposition to any unilateral coercive action that seeks to undermine Japan's administrative control of the Senkaku Islands.
Last year, President Obama confirmed that the U.S.-Japan security treaties apply to the Japanese-administered islands, which are called Jiaoyu in China. In recent years, China has challenged Japan's control of the uninhabited islands with repeated air and naval patrols near the disputed territory. China has used similar assertive tactics to strengthen its wide-ranging claims to other disputed areas in the nearby South China Sea, unnerving many of its neighbors. The U.S. says it does not take a stance in the disputes, but Washington officials have repeatedly called on China to rein in its aggressive behavior, a view echoed Wednesday by Secretary Carter.
Making sure that there are no changes in the status quo that are made coercively and that territorial disputes, which are longstanding, are not militarized. The United States has long opposed that kind of activity on the part of anyone.
Responding to Carter's statements, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Hua Chunying called on the U.S. to be more responsible. China has also expressed concern at Japan's efforts to take on a greater security role in the Asia-Pacific. This week, North Korea is convening its first major parliamentary meeting of the year. It is a scripted event that is widely seen as a facade to give the authoritarian rule of Kim Jong-un the appearance of democratic support. But VOA's Brian Padden reports these sessions might offer some insight into the leadership's grasp on power and the stability of the regime.
The third session of the 13th Supreme People's Assembly of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea will bring together 687 representatives from the country. These legislative sessions are highly orchestrated. The delegates all vote in favor of all motions without debate. The elaborate presentation is designed to showcase the power and prestige of Kim Jong-un, the third-generation supreme leader of the country. Little is actually known about how real power is exercised and decisions are made inside this secretive totalitarian regime. But analysts and foreign intelligence agencies study these public sessions to assess who may be gaining influence and how they might affect economic and security policies. An Chan Il, a North Korean defector and head of the World Institute for North Korea Studies, says Kim Jong-un's recent appointments were older military and party leaders tied to his father's pro-nuclear development policies. He says these moves indicate Mr. Kim is unable to pursue reforms he may have initially wanted. He says in major construction, development of nuclear weapons, enhancement of asymmetrical power, and organization of strategic military, Kim Jong-un's regime may have been trying to get away from the military-first politic, but he cannot get out of it and is still hovering in the same spot. John Jing-seong, also a North Korean defector and professor at Leiden University in the Netherlands, believes Kim Jong-un is trapped in the power structure created by his father. He says the difference between Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-un is that Kim Jong-il is a dictator of his own making by his own hands, while Kim Jong-un is a hereditary successor. This is a big difference. Staged events like the People's Assembly are part of the extensive propaganda efforts aimed at nurturing the cult of personality around the Kim family, portraying the leader as an infallible, godlike figure. Determining what the public or top officials really think about an issue is virtually impossible in the totalitarian country. Very few outsiders are allowed to visit North Korea, and there are virtually no opportunities for foreigners to informally discuss political topics with North Korean officials. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
A U.S. soldier was killed and at least two others wounded Wednesday in eastern Afghanistan when an Afghan National Army soldier opened fire on them. As Ayaz Gul reports from Islamabad, the assailant was killed in return fire, and officials say the incident is under investigation.
The latest so-called insider attack took place in the eastern Afghan city of Jalalabad shortly after a senior American diplomat concluded security talks with regional leaders. Provincial Police Chief Fazil Ahmed Sheherzad says a group of American soldiers from the NATO-led Resolute Support Mission assisted in providing security to the high-level meeting at the provincial governor's office. He says as soon as the meeting ended and the guests were flown out of the compound, the group of American soldiers along with Afghan forces began leaving the area. Sheherzad says suddenly a member of the National Army aboard a police vehicle opened fire at them with his machine gun, prompting a firefight. The police chief says the retaliatory action killed the Afghan soldier and wounded two others. He refused to provide details of the American casualties, but a NATO statement later confirmed one of its soldiers was killed in the attack without discussing his nationality. The U.S. Embassy said all of its staff were accounted for and returned safely to their mission's headquarters in Kabul. This is the second time this year in which Afghan security forces have turned their guns on NATO partners. In January, an Afghan soldier killed three American contractors before he was killed in return fire. The motive for Wednesday's attack is not immediately clear, and Police Chief Sheherzad denied reports a verbal exchange between Afghan and American forces led to the shootout. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
I'm David Berg. Daybreak Asia is a weekday feature of VOA. If you'd like to hear longer versions of these stories, as well as see videos and photos, log on to our website, www.voanews.com. And our free Daybreak Asia podcast is available for download. You can find it at www.voanews.com/archive/daybreak-asia. We always welcome your feedback and your ideas about our show. You can send them to us on Facebook, Twitter, Weibo, and at voaasia@voanews.com. Now, here's some of what folks are saying about some stories that we've covered. You heard about Defense Secretary Ashton Carter's trip to Japan and his laying out of the U.S. commitment to Japanese security Wednesday. Well, according to Matsumoto Hidaki from Japan, he says, "Yeah, sure. Hey, America, let me tell you a secret. Nobody trusts you anymore." Donald Fraser Miles from Elliott Lake, Canada, says his own reading of the Japan situation is that they're seeking an independent military path as their longer-term objective. The Canadian says, judging from NHK News reports on World War II-related topics, Japan does not have any genuinely warmer attitudes towards the U.S. than it does towards China. Meanwhile, we reported about the international human rights group Amnesty International saying the Afghan government is doing nothing to stop a trend of escalating violence against women in its country. CEO from Japan said women are waiting and nobody can help. And South Korean businessmen say that North Korea is willing to settle a dispute over the Kaesong Industrial Complex just north of the DMZ. Sam Kim from Busan wrote the North Korean officials have been using Kaesong for not only as their money-making source, but also tools for political negotiations. The North Koreans are known as an untrustworthy communist body in the world. The Kaesong Industrial Complex keeps going for 53,000 North Korean workers and for their families. Coming up, there's a verdict in the trial of a man accused in the Boston Marathon bombing. Iran sends Navy ships towards Yemen. There's some high-priced real estate for setting records in New York City. And country singer Darius Rucker has a number one single. That and a look at the Masters Golf Tournament coming up later on.
History has a long history of being manipulated, making its teaching and learning both fascinating and tricky. I'm Jim Stevenson with Authors on Asia. We open the book today with Karina Kostolina, a professor at George Mason University near Washington. She explores these ideas in a new book, History Education in the Formation of Social Identity. Kostolina says history education is actually about looking forward rather than to the past.
History education actually not only create knowledge about history, but create our perception of who our enemies, who are our friends, and why they did it to us, what we should do. So history education actually oriented more for future and for current events than for to the past.
It would seem that if we're using history education toward the promotion of peace, perhaps we haven't done such a good job of it in the past, considering what has been going on recently.
Yes, for many countries, history education is probably one of the most powerful mechanisms how to create national loyalties, perceptions of patriotism, and, of course, nationalism in this situation. And, of course, in this situation, it's important for government, especially in totalitarian regimes, post-conflict regimes, to present other groups as perpetrators, present them as aggressive, cruel, violent, to justify their own actions. So history education is really everything about justification of positivity of our nation and negative violent intentions of other nations. It's all about justification of current regime and current policy.
And that has been the way history education has been couched, that the winners of the wars get to write the history of what happened.
Yes, of course. The idea of truth is not even truthful, if I put it this way. The problem of history is that it's repeated every single time, but it's repeated not only for winners or against losers, but it's also rewritten to create particular ideology. It's rewritten to support particular groups, even within the nation.
For a country like North Korea, the use of ideology in history is so important, at least internally. And that, in a way, seems to have hampered efforts over more than 60 years to even come to some sort of a peace treaty with North Korea.
Oh, yeah. For North Korea, history education is probably one of the most powerful tools, because they actually use every single effort to show that North Korean identity has real Koreanness, while the South Korea is completely submitted to the West, lost its ethnic identity, and only North Korea still holds it. Moreover, the idea of the leadership is so strongly incorporated into the very core of national identity in North Korea. For example, if you take history textbook, it's actually called Life and Achievements of Our Leader.
So as education becomes more global and more students study abroad in different countries, how do they reconcile these different accounts of history?
This is a really interesting question, because in many cases where people come to a new country and they see that history is completely different, it could be a shock. But it's very important that people really open this comparative view, they start understanding that there are no one narrative. Because while if people have just only one narrative and they believe that it's the only truth, it's very hard to create any type of tolerance, any types of shared society, any type of peaceful perceptions of other groups.
Karina Kostolina, a professor at George Mason University and author of History Education and the Formation of Social Identity Toward a Culture of Peace. It is published by Palgrave Macmillan. I'm Jim Stevenson. We'll pull another volume from our bookshelves next week when you may hear more authors on Asia on VOA Global or anytime by visiting the voanews.com website, VOA Asia Facebook page, and SoundCloud.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. U.S. Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter laid out the U.S. commitment to Japanese security Wednesday, urging restraint in territorial disputes between Japan and China. The secretary's remarks came as he began his first Asia tour in Tokyo. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb reports.
China's dispute with Japan over Japanese-controlled islands in the East China Sea and its controversial actions in the South China Sea set the backdrop for U.S. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter's talks with Japan's defense minister.
We don't, as we frequently say, take a stand in any of those territorial disputes. We take a strong stand against militarization of those disputes.
Carter's meeting with Defense Minister Jen Nakatani reaffirmed the United States' rebalance to the Asia-Pacific, which involves shifting more political and military weight to the fast-growing region. It's a shift Japan expert Sheila Smith says is very important.
We're at a particularly critical moment, I think, in the Asia-Pacific, and everybody looks over across the Pacific and they see this rising new China.
China's defense spending has increased by double digits for five consecutive years. The United States is counterbalancing this rise by strengthening regional alliances, but says it does not want to contain China. Carter's Tokyo meetings are aimed at firming up Japan's new guidelines on defense cooperation with the United States.
I think the guidelines are going to be very effective in making sure that nobody miscalculates the importance of this alliance for both of our countries.
In China, state-backed media claim Japan is using the United States' increasing reliance on its Asian ally to inflame tensions on historical and territorial issues. Officials will finalize the Japan guidelines at the end of this month when Prime Minister Shinzo Abe visits President Barack Obama in Washington. They'll include new security cooperation in cyber and space domains and increased military coordination. Carla Babb, VOA News, Tokyo.
On Wednesday, a U.S. jury convicted Chechen immigrant Jokhar Tsarnaev of helping his brother carry out the 2013 Boston Marathon bombings that killed three people and injured another 264. One of the three people killed in the bombings was 23-year-old Chinese student Lingzi Liu. A graduate student at Boston University, she went with friends to watch the marathon and was standing near the finish line when she was struck. A scholarship has been set up at Boston University that funds graduate study for students from China. In November 2013, I interviewed Liu's former roommate, Jing Li, also from China, who described her late friend.
We really enjoyed our life at Boston and at BU. And first, both of us, we are involved in the fields that we truly love. Lindsay, she's very hardworking and she was very good at math. And I remember that she often came to me very happily and told me that, oh, she got a really high grade in her exams. Although that we are away from home, but we became very independent. We learned to be healthy independent and to support each other.
Now, I wanted to ask you, the Lindsay Liu Memorial Scholarship Fund has now reached, it's at least $1 million. I think people are still contributing, so it's still open and it might go even higher. But what is your reaction to this scholarship fund and the success of it?
I still remember that at the time when I heard that you determined to establish this scholarship for Lindsay, I was very touched because the scholarship will be always there and the scholarship can help people to remember Lindsay and honor her life forever. The scholarship It can not only provide great financial help to the students who are coming to BU, but the scholarship, I think it can largely inspire the students who shared the same dream and ambitions with her. And because we all know that she's a very intelligent and hardworking student, and she has a lot of unfinished dreams. And so the scholarship, it will encourage the students in the future who will come to study here. And she's like the role model for the future students and encourage them to study hard, play hard, and cherish every moment in their life, and also make every moment meaningful.
Jing Li, the former roommate of Boston Marathon bombing victim Lindsay Liu. Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
In Asian business news, Chinese train makers CSR and CNR both saw gains in their stock prices after the Chinese government approved their merger. CSR shares closed up 45%. CNR shares were up 42% Wednesday in Hong Kong. Now, the two stocks resumed trading after they had been halted March 30th, pending regulatory approval of the merger. The two train makers are consolidating as part of a Chinese strategy to create industry-leading companies that are able to compete internationally, with the world's largest high-speed rail network. China is making a push to market its rail technology overseas through such campaigns as President Xi Jinping's One Belt, One Road strategy to form a tighter network of trade links across Asia and Europe. The Federal Aviation Administration has upgraded India's rating category from Category 2 to Category 1, according to a statement from the U.S. Embassy in Delhi. An FAA team visited India last month after reviewing that country's aviation regulator in December. The move comes after a series of fatal crashes last year focused attention on air safety in Asia. The upgrade means that Indian airlines can expand their service to the United States and enter into code share agreements with U.S. carriers. State-owned Air India Limited and Jet Airways India Limited are currently only two Indian airlines that offer service to the United States. In Asian stock market trading on Wednesday, prices were mostly higher. In Tokyo, the Nikkei Index rose more than 0.75% to close at 19,789.81. Hong Kong's Hang Seng Index was up 3.8%. Shanghai's Shenzhen CSI 300 Index was up 0.84% to 4,295.80.
This is Today in History. On April 9th, 1626, English philosopher and statesman Sir Francis Bacon died. When charges of corruption forced his retirement from government service, he turned to literary and scientific activities and is known as an advocate of inductive reasoning and the scientific method. On this date in 1682, the French explorer Robert La Salle claimed the lands around the mouth of the Mississippi River for France, renaming the territory Louisiana in honor of King Louis XIV. In 1865, Confederate General Robert E. Lee met with Union General Ulysses S. Grant at Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia to discuss terms of surrender. The surrender effectively ended America's Civil War, a conflict that resulted in over a million casualties. In 1867, the United States Senate agreed by a single vote to a treaty purchasing the territory of Alaska from Russia. In 1914, the first full-color movie was shown. The film shown in London was titled The World, the Flesh, and the Devil. In 1939, noted singer Marian Anderson performed to a crowd of 75,000 gathered at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. Anderson had been denied entrance to the racially segregated Constitution Hall, but had been invited by the First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, to sing at the memorial. In 1940, Nazi Germany invaded Norway and Denmark. In 1959, the U.S. space agency NASA introduced seven astronauts to the public. They would take part in America's first manned space program, Project Mercury. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Boston Marathon bomber convicted on all counts. Iran sends Navy vessels to Yemen amid airstrikes. Insider attack kills American soldier in Afghanistan. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. A U.S. jury Wednesday convicted Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, a Chechen immigrant, of helping his brother carry out the 2013 Boston Marathon bombings. They killed three people and injured another 264. The jury deliberated for more than 11 hours over 2 days before convicting the 21-year-old Tsarnaev of all 30 charges he faced. 17 of them carry a possible death penalty. VOA's Fatima Tsilsova was in the courtroom when the verdicts were announced.
All the charges, including the conspiracy, use of weapons of mass destruction, murder of four people, all of charges were recognized as guilty.
The case against Tsarnaev now heads to a second phase, with the jury hearing more testimony before deciding whether to sentence him to life in prison or death. The Tsarnaev lawyers contend that the older brother, 26-year-old Tamerlan Tsarnaev, killed in a police shootout, was actually the driving force behind the attack. They are now trying to secure a life prison term for Dzhokhar rather than a death penalty. A state-run media outlet in Iran reports that Iranian Navy ships have left for waters near Yemen amid a Saudi-led airstrike campaign to halt the advance of Iranian-backed Shiite rebels in the country. Iranian Rear Admiral Habibullah Sayeri says the fleet will provide safety for Iran's shipping lanes and protect the country's interests in the high seas. The fleet, which includes a destroyer and another vessel, is sailing to the Gulf of Aden and the Bab al-Mandab Strait, the main access point to the Red Sea for ships going to the Suez Canal. Egypt has also sent naval vessels to waters off the Yemeni coast. Iran's foreign minister is on a two-day trip to Pakistan as part of an effort by both countries to find a diplomatic solution to the crisis in Yemen. Aisha Tanzim has details.
Well, I think one possibility is a Security Council action.
That's Pakistan's advisor on foreign affairs, or de facto foreign minister, Sartaj Aziz, at a joint press conference with Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif. Aziz suggested that the United Nations Security Council adopt a resolution that enforces a ceasefire in Yemen, as well as puts an embargo on arms supplies and finally disarms the Houthis. The Iranian foreign minister seemed to disagree.
This should be left to the Yemenis to decide. We in the outside world, in the region, can only facilitate.
Both Iran and Pakistan have been engaged in intense diplomacy on this issue during the last few days with other regional and Muslim countries like Turkey and Jordan. Zarif said that all of his country's efforts were organized along four principles.
Ceasefire, humanitarian assistance, intra-Yemeni dialogue, and broad-based government.
Zarif indicated that his country was willing to use its influence with the Houthi rebels to secure an immediate ceasefire in Yemen. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
Kurdish security officials say the Islamic State group has freed at least 216 members of Iraq's Yazidi community who had been held captive for 8 months. Witnesses say the handover took place Wednesday in the northern province of Kirkuk, and that most of the Yazidis are elderly and in poor health. The reason for the release was not clear. Meanwhile, Iraqi security forces launched a new offensive against Islamic State fighters in Anbar province in western Iraq, seeking to build on momentum gained following last week's defeat of IS militants in the northern city of Tikrit. An Afghan National Army soldier opened fire on U.S. troops in Jalalabad Wednesday, killing one American before being killed in return fire. The gunfire erupted just after Afghan provincial officials met with a U.S. embassy official in the provincial governor's compound. There's been no claim of responsibility. The American soldier killed in the incident was helping to train and advise Afghan troops. India's envoy to Pakistan brushed aside Islamabad's assertions that rapid increases in its nuclear arsenal, including short-range tactical nuclear weapons, are serving as a deterrent to another war between the two countries. Ayaz Ghul has details.
Pakistani authorities insist the nuclear weapons have deterred another war with India, helping to maintain regional peace. Indian envoy to Pakistan, TCA Raghavan, dismisses these assertions, saying an increase in the nuclear arsenal is not a way of building confidence.
I believe the way forward is to address issues of political trust, address issues of concern with regard to terrorism and extremism.
Indian diplomat Raghavan disagreed with suggestions the nuclear negotiations between Iran and the United States sets an example for India and Pakistan to work together to ease growing nuclear dangers in South Asia. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
A white police officer in the southeastern U.S. state of South Carolina was dismissed after a video showed him firing repeated shots at a fleeing unarmed black man and killing him after a traffic stop. Officer Michael Slager was fired and accused of murder in the killing last Saturday of 50-year-old Walter Scott after the policeman pulled him over for driving with a broken brake light in North Charleston. The video, taken by a bystander with a cell phone camera, shows Slager firing 8 shots at Scott. North Charleston's mayor and police chief visited Scott's family to voice their sympathy over the killing, but declined to answer numerous questions about it. They said the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, the state's criminal investigative body, is taking over the probe, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation is also starting one of its own. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras met with Russian President Vladimir Putin for bilateral talks in Moscow Wednesday, Mr. Putin indicating Russia could lift its embargo on food imports from Greece. He said that the leader of Greece did not ask for financial aid. A former detainee of the U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, was arrested in Uganda on suspicion of playing a role in the killing last month of a prosecutor who handled terror cases. Jamal Kayemba, a Ugandan, was arrested along with 3 others in the capital, Kampala. Officials say U.S. government personnel supported the operation that led to Kayemba's arrest. About 1,000 gang members and associates from 239 different gangs were arrested across the United States in an operation headed by Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents. The sweep, named Project Wildfire, was aimed at criminal gangs that work across international borders. The operation picked up 976 gang members and associates in 282 cities. Most of them are U.S. citizens, but 199 are foreign nationals from 18 countries in South and Central America, Asia, Africa, Europe, and the Caribbean. Thank you for joining us today on International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
In U.S. business news, electric car maker Tesla Motors is going after the mainstream luxury car buyers. It's added all-wheel drive and more range and power to the base version of its only car. You'll know that that is the S model. But the added features do not come cheap. They will line up with about a 7% price increase to $75,000 for those of you who want the electric-powered vehicle. Now, that base lease price will rise to $838 per month from $796 for just over 19,000 kilometers per year. CEO Elon Musk says that with a $7,500 federal tax credit that takes the price to $67,500, plus tax credits in some states, the new version is price competitive with BMW's midsize 5 Series or the Mercedes E-Class. Mark Pincus is back as the CEO of Zynga, the struggling online game company that he founded. He takes over for Don Matrick, who was the former head of Microsoft's Xbox division, who took over from Pincus 2 years ago. The San Francisco company says Matrick is out as CEO and as a board member and Zynga employee, effective immediately. Now, Zynga is best known for games such as Farmville and Words with Friends, and it was, at one time, by far the most popular company on Facebook, but it lost some of that luster in recent years as people moved on to other games and mobile devices. On Wall Street, U.S. stocks posted modest gains after the minutes from a U.S. Federal Reserve meeting indicated the central bank will raise interest rates later this year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up about 0.15%. The S&P 500 was up a little bit over 0.25%. The NASDAQ added 0.83%. Coming up, producers of China's version of the Voice singing competition scour the globe looking for talent for season 4. Multi-million dollar high-rise apartments in New York City set records. How do animals keep warm in the zoo during cold weather? And Darius Rucker has a number one country song.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. $130 million, $150 million. Those are the latest record-setting prices on high-rise residences in New York City, as VOA's Bernard Chessman reports.
A total of 12 skyscraper residential buildings are in various stages of development, most in one stretch of one street, 57th Street in Midtown Manhattan. With each new high-rise residential unit comes a high price tag, $30 to $40 million for a luxury apartment that may never be lived in is becoming commonplace. According to a report in the New York Times, shell companies, or inactive companies used for financial maneuvers, own many of these units. No problem, says lawyer Edward Mermelstein, who represents several foreign investors in the United States. He calls New York City a bargain and says his clients pay cash and want in.
You have a very strong international buyer pool, but they're seeing New York as a value play. They still see the fact that New York, in comparison to other cities, is less expensive, and there's a lot of room for growth.
Architectural critic and educator Paul Goldberger agrees, but he sees a downside to absentee ownership for New York City.
It almost goes without saying that they don't pay income taxes because their residence, official primary residence, is not here. But they're not paying property taxes either in most cases. And there have been some loopholes in our zoning legislation that have allowed these very, very tall buildings to go up, particularly on 57th Street, without much public review.
That hot zoning issue was topic one at a recent meeting of the local community board. The board wants changes in city zoning laws and called this skyscraper picket fence development a problem for the general public. Community board member Leila Lodzisicko.
These buildings are going to cast enormous shadows on Central Park. That means that during the daytime, it will be colder in winter to a point that people will no longer be able to use the park.
Developers are not talking. They're building. And on the drawing board is a proposed Western Hemisphere record breaker, 433 meters high, also on 57th Street, in what is now being called Billionaire's Row. Bernard Chessman, VOA News, New York.
It's been a cold winter across much of the United States. While humans could put on coats or stay warm inside, animals in zoos need to be protected both from the winter cold and heat in the summer. VOA's Deborah Block visited the Smithsonian National Zoo in Washington to find out how the animals are kept comfortable all year long. And she joins us now in the cafe.
There's nothing cuter than a baby giant panda at the National Zoo discovering snow for the first time.
They love being in the snow. They love to romp in the snow.
National Zoo scientist Don Moore says the pandas can tolerate Washington's cold winters and hot, humid summers because the temperatures are similar to their native environment.
Giant pandas are from the mountains of China, and it gets very, very cold there in the wintertime, and it gets between 70 and 85 degrees there. Fahrenheit in the summertime.
Panda's climate-controlled indoor area keeps them comfortable all year long at a temperature between 15 to 21 degrees Celsius. Asian elephants prefer warmer conditions, but can maintain their body heat even when it's cold. Of course, some of the 400 species in the zoo never have to worry about the weather, since they live in various climate-controlled environments. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
I'm Ira Melman with your invitation to join me in the American Cafe every day at voanews.com and many podcast platforms.
everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. You might have seen the television show The Voice with celebrity judges Adam Levine, Blake Shelton, Christina Aguilera, and others judging a singing competition. Well, in China's version of the show, it's now the fourth season, and producers are scouring the world looking for Chinese talent. This year, producers are holding auditions in Australia, the United States, and in Europe, with a final battle set for London on May 10th for the European round. Daniel Chan is the project director at Orient Touch Entertainment. He says that the Chinese show wants to find the perfect candidates to audition for the judges.
The show has grown so much lately in China, and with 1.3 billion people there, it can only get better and better and bigger and bigger. And now we even go, well, overseas just to find the perfect contestant as well. So basically the show is also recruiting in Australia, even in the US as well. So we have like overseas auditions to find the perfect candidate to actually represent their region and also to sing in China.
William Lee is one of the candidates hoping to make it on the Chinese version of The Voice. He says that even if he doesn't win, getting the exposure in the Chinese market will help boost his career.
They've had loads of people that's come out, even like non-winners come out, who've been able to release albums and make a career out of it. So, I mean, even, you know, there are so many people here today that are absolutely amazing. And even if I get just that little bit of chance to be on TV, to get that limelight, hopefully I'll be able to kind of use that to my advantage and, make my dream of becoming a singer.
Contestants are asked to upload 3 songs online. Those who impress the show producers then move on to audition for the people who will eventually choose who goes to the blind auditions in front of the judges. Daniel Chan says the show has had some surprising successes in its first 3 seasons, and that has inspired people to think that they can make it.
There were candidates who didn't have anything, and they joined the competition and they become a pop star. And I think this gives a lot of people the opportunity to really to show themselves and show their talents and make it recognized by the people in China. And it has grown. This is the fourth season already, and it's only getting bigger and bigger.
One of those hoping to make it is Gareth Chow, a fashion student in London. He says that even the Chinese songs that are usually performed on the show are being replaced by English pop hits.
Not many, but I think it is the style of the music, just that difference. But I think now, because if they already finished the third season, so it's getting more and more globalized in the music style, because many I saw many people, they sing English songs, and actually they sing very well.
Evelyn Yi is another contestant auditioning in London. She says that the longer she goes in the competition, the more she has to battle her nerves.
Because I often go to the karaoke and then I put the music, like the recorded online, and then my friends and heard it, said, "You definitely can go for it. You have to try. You must try. You can go for this. You have to, like, enter this competition to give you a chance and to push yourself." I say, okay.
15 finalists will be selected from across Europe, and they will meet in a battle round May 10th at London's Garrick Theatre in front of judges Alfred Hui, Zhou Shen, and Li Wei. The winner of this round will go on to audition for the Chinese television show's fourth season. So are you a fan of The Voice, either in China or somewhere else? Have you ever thought of entering a singing competition like this? Maybe you did. Let us know how you did and your thoughts by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And you can email your questions or comments to voaasia@voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd. Coming up, an Indiana Pacers player and two others are stabbed outside a Manhattan nightclub. The Masters Golf Tournament tees off Thursday in Augusta, Georgia. And we'll hear about Darius Rucker's new album and his number one country single. And hey, there's no sleeping allowed in the displays in the Beijing IKEA store. Opening up the sports page, Indiana Pacers forward Chris Copeland, his wife, and another woman were stabbed early Wednesday outside a Manhattan nightclub following an argument. Police said the couple was arguing outside the One Oak Club in Chelsea when the attacker eavesdropped and started to interfere. Apparently, the dispute escalated until the 22-year-old attacker pulled out a knife and started slashing. The suspect has been arrested and charges are pending. Copeland was stabbed in the left elbow and abdomen, and his wife was slashed in the arm and across the breast. The second woman, who was believed to have been with the attacker, was cut in the abdomen. Two Atlanta Hawks players, Peron Antic and Thabo Sulafosha, were arrested on charges of obstructing the crime scene after police said they blocked officers from trying to start their investigation. On the basketball courts, the winning tradition continued in women's hoops when the University of Connecticut defeated Notre Dame 63-53 to take the NCAA title. Mariah Jefferson scored 15 points for the Huskies, who won their third straight national title. For Coach Gino Auriemma, it was his 10th overall. Jack Nicklaus showed that age is just a number in the par 3 competition ahead of the Masters. The man known as the Golden Bear, who has 18 major titles in his career, hit a hole-in-one. The 75-year-old Nicklaus watched his tee shot sail over the water hazard, land past the pin, and then take three bounces and slowly roll back down into the cup. The six-time Masters champion flashed that winning smile and received congratulatory handshakes from some of the other players in his group, Ben Crenshaw and Gary Player. According to his website, Jack Nicklaus hit 20 aces in his professional career, which spanned about, 1962 to 2003, and did include those 18 major victories. The annual par 3 competition also featured a four-time champion, Tiger Woods, and his two children, 7-year-old daughter Sam and 6-year-old son Charlie, serving as his caddies. And the Masters, the first major tournament of the year, does tee off Thursday in Augusta, Georgia. Defending champion Bubba Watson tees off at 9:24 a.m. Tiger Woods, who is playing in his first tournament since February, tees off at 1:48. Tiger has not won a major since the 2008 U.S. Open. Know Darius Rucker as the frontman for the 1990s pop group Hootie and the Blowfish. Or you might know him from his Grammy-winning country song Wagon Wheel last year. Well, now Rucker has a number one song, Homegrown Honey, which he co-wrote with Charles Kelly of Lady Antebellum. Rucker's fourth album, Southern Style, was released last week. He says he started work more than a year ago and wrote more than 50 songs for the project, but only 13, including Homegrown Honey, made the list. Darius says that he wanted to write some songs that would be more good time after his last album, True Believers, was more serious.
The last record was such a serious record. True Believers was such a serious record. And with this record, I really went in with that attitude of, let's have some fun. You know, let's write some big drinking songs and, you know, some... you know, love and life songs and just have some fun. And we did that. And yeah, I think it's probably a little more country than the other stuff I've done.
Darius kept true to form when he and Kelly wrote Homegrown Honey with Nathan Chapman. Rucker says that working with Kelly and the other writers got his creative juices flowing and the songs just kept coming.
He's my guy, man. Charles and I are pretty tight. And it was fun. He is just so funny, so laid back. You know, we were having a couple beers. You know, we had a little party going on in there between the three of us. And he's just, the song just kept coming. And everybody was saying these cool lines. And then somebody would say, just say it a little different. And it just worked exactly like the writing session is supposed to work, you know. And we had a great time. And Yeah, I mean, I'm proud of that song. You know, anytime you have a number one song, it's awesome.
Darius says that he has been surprised by the success he has had in country music, including being inducted into the Grand Ole Opry. The South Carolina native says he is still amazed at how far he has come since he started Hootie and the Blowfish way back in the mid-1980s.
Oh, it's been crazy. I just didn't expect this. I was really doing it just because I wanted to make a country record. And even after I got a record deal, I was just thinking, I hope they let me make another one. You know, I really wasn't thinking about hits. Or anything. And then when Don't Think, I Don't Think About It started to take off, you started thinking, wow, this is crazy. And when I stopped, I do it a lot, man, because you know, when you're getting my age and after you've lived the life I've lived, you want to reflect now so you can remember everything that went on, you know. And I stop a lot and I think, you know, man, this was just crazy run. I mean, the stuff I've gotten to do and the fun I've had and the hits I've had and all that stuff, it's just been a crazy fun run. And you know, it's all good. I mean, it's all because one president of one record label had the cojones to sign me, and it's been awesome.
And what about getting together with the old bandmates for some shows? Darius says his work with his former Blowfish bandmates has never stopped, even during his solo career.
We're brothers, man. You know, we've been a band together for 30 years, and so our kids call, you know, all of our kids call Uncle Dean and Uncle Darius and Uncle Sony, you know, and we were just together at the show. But we're brothers, and we play all the time, and we know we're going to do it, but we're not going to do it until it's right.
With all his success, Darius Rucker says that there's something he would still like to do musically, collaborate on a rap album. Now, that's nothing new for country musicians. Florida Georgia Line worked with Nelly for Cruise, and Jake Owen and T-Pain worked together on Beachin'. Darius says that he would like to be next.
I'd work with anybody. You know, one of my bucket list, I don't have much left on my bucket list, and one of the things I'm dying to do is to sing the hook on a big rap song. I'm dying to do that. No one's ever called me to do that. I'm dying to do that.
For now, Darius Rucker is getting ready to start his next tour, beginning May 14th in New Jersey. From his new album, here's Darius Rucker with his number one single, Homegrown Honey.
Ooh, I dig the way that you move. You take it down to your roots. How did your mama teach you how to do that thing you do? Yeah, nothing sweeter than wild. I'll take a sip for that. I bet the boys at home can't leave you alone, you little homegrown. Honey, 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 y'all so money, money, money. You got a country road, Carolina soul. Baby, you're just so homegrown. Y'all so money, money, money. You got a country road, Carolina soul. Baby, you're just so homegrown.
Do you like to shop at IKEA? You know, the place with the put-together kind of do-it-yourself furniture, no instructions, just pictures. End up calling the toll-free number maybe to try to find out what you're doing wrong. I do that. Well, anyone who has been in an IKEA store knows that the Swedish retailer has displays of its furniture and other products so you can see what they will eventually look like in your home. But apparently in Beijing, sleeping on those displays is a no-no. The Beijing IKEA is asking shoppers to stop napping on its furniture displays. Apparently, some patrons were taking things a little bit too far. The South China Morning Post reports that some shoppers would just occupy all the beds and the couches in the Beijing store in order to take a nap. An IKEA spokesman said the company doesn't see it as a problem. Josefin Thorell told the Wall Street Journal last year that IKEA is happy that people feel at home in their stores. Thanks for joining us on VOA Global. You can hear any of our podcasts by logging on to our website, www.voanews.com. You can also download them there. Tracy Carter directed our program today. Aydin Utku was our engineer. Diane Gao is the managing editor of VOA English, and I'm David Byrd in Washington.